Please pray with me.
May the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable to you, O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Second Peter. It's a letter that scholars will date back to the year 100 CE, maybe even as late as 150. It's the last written work to work itself into the Bible. The author writes as an eyewitness, "We were there, we were on the mountaintop with Jesus, and we heard God's voice. I was there." Yet, who wasn't? The writer of this letter wasn't on the mountain with Jesus. The writer's first words of his letter may be Simon Peter, a servant and apostle of Jesus the Christ, but this writer is not the same Peter that climbed the mountain with Jesus. You remember the stories of Peter, that fisherman called by Jesus at the Sea of Galilee, called to be a disciple. Peter, the real eyewitness to the transfiguration. The one named Simon Peter, the one Jesus named Cephas, a stone, and later called him Petros, the rock. The Peter who died on a cross in Rome in 64 CE. That Peter could not have written this letter in 100 to 150 CE. So why the passionate eyewitness drama by whoever wrote 2 Peter? Perhaps writing through the hand of Peter the Apostle would give gravitas to the words this author frantically pens to the young church he feared was losing its way. The writer loves his people. He wants them to remember the faith. He wants them to escape the corruption of the world he knows. He wants his people to know that they are God's beloved children with all the grace and peace that comes with that knowledge. And he is dying. The verse before, the very first verse in today's lesson was, "I will make every effort so that after my death and departure, you may be able at any time to recall these things." This is the last written piece of the New Testament, and it is also the last will and testament left to the apostolic church, the first church, by one whose life had been transfigured. The letter models faith in God and God's beloved and a way of life that follows that faith. Now, there are several separate sermons we could work through today. Let me just run through them. It's only a 3-chapter book. How many could there be, right? First, might be a sermon on the primitive Christian hope that Jesus would soon return and establish his kingdom and eliminate evil from the universe. It's a nice mix of the second coming and the day of judgment. It's the scare them into believing approach to faith over against God's lavish grace. Another sermon could be entitled, "What to Do with False Teachers," or "Eliminate Your Opponents." The author devotes the entire second chapter of 2 Peter is devoted to that subject of what to do with those other people. Such sermons might have traction today. However, one resource I read points out that the writer seems totally unaware of any incongruity between the teaching of Christian love on one hand and the savage abuse of fellow believers who disagree with you on the other. Too much to think through today. A third topic available is a little more dense than that: the underpinnings of United States Christian Zionism that emerge in this text. Levels of the universe, God's destruction, and the need to hurry up the end times as we know it. Definitely topics for another day. For today, we're just going to stick with this. Does the fact that the author wasn't an eyewitness to what we call the transfiguration mean that we should discard the letter and his passion? The answer is no. The last will and testament of 2 Peter, placed in the lectionary on this day, is a reminder that the story of transfiguration is not confined to just Moses and Jesus, with glowing Cecil B. DeMille faces and dazzling white robes. Transfiguration is about being an eyewitness to the holy that leads to change. It's positive change, like the metamorphosis from an inching along furry caterpillar to that visually captivating blue morpho butterfly. Whatever the experiences, be it an event, a moment, or a person, one's form or appearance changes forever into something more beautiful or more spiritual. 2 Peter encountered the divine, the holy, in a way that changed him forever. He shares his passion, and he wants us to share the story. Changed forever, like a handprint on our hearts, changed for good. Whatever the stories of faith, they need to be told. Gathered up from the past, told in the present, so that we might grow in the knowledge of God's grace in every time. This morning, during the final hours of Black History Month, I'd like to share with you a few stories of faith from African Americans whose lives might give us an eyewitness account of the transfiguration. Lives changed for the good. An obvious place to start this morning is Martin Luther King Jr., orator, scholar, social activist, preacher, and pastor. His mother was a teacher. His father was a preacher. He was born into the stories of faith. In King's final speech, he lives the way of Jesus, daring to take on toxic, dominant systems of oppression. And he dares to invoke the transfiguration itself. At the age of 39, King delivered a speech in Memphis, Tennessee, in support of the striking sanitation workers. King ended the speech with these words: "I don't know what's going to happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop, and I don't mind. Like anybody, I'd like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain, and I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. And I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything, and I'm not fearing anything. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord." Less than 24 hours after these prophetic words, King was assassinated by James Earl Ray. Transfigured, life changed for good, forever. The Presbyterian Church USA family has several transfiguration stories of change for good. John Gloucester was born a slave in the early years of the American Revolution. In the hills of Tennessee, Gloucester encountered a white Presbyterian minister, missionary, and educator, who worked among the five civilized tribes in the Cherokee Nation. The pastor's name was Gideon Blackburn. Blackburn saw potential in this young man, Gloucester, and he bought him from the owner, so that this man could be his personal servant. He then went ahead and trained Gloucester, and educated him, and with contacts, Gloucester became the first African American to actually attend Greenville College in Tennessee, where Blackburn was a trustee, a positive testament to white privilege. In 1806, Gloucester came under care of the Presbyter of the Union of Tennessee. It was at the same time that there was a pastor in Philadelphia, Dr. Archibald Alexander. He had started a church. It was a Third Presbyterian church. They had a group called the Evangelical Society of Philadelphia. This group was part of the church, and every Sunday night they would go out two by twos to evangelize to the masses of free slaves that were moving into Philadelphia and were living in poverty-ridden areas outside of Philadelphia. After a while, the church realized they could no longer just go out every Sunday night. They needed to help that area of town build their own church with an African-American pastor. But there were none. It was at that time that Archibald Alexander heard about Gloucester and that he had come under care in Tennessee. Just so happened that year, the General Assembly was in Philadelphia, and Blackburn, the mentor of this young man, was a commissioner. Alexander, the pastor of Philadelphia, sat down with the missionary Blackburn, and they made an arrangement. Gloucester would come to Philadelphia to start the new church. It was at that point that Blackburn gave him his freedom. On May 1807, John Gloucester was a street preacher in Philadelphia on Sundays at 7th and Shippen Streets, but he was doing it without a license. During this time, he had also left his family in bondage in Tennessee. They were not allowed to have their payment. Eventually, Gloucester raised the money to bring them to Philadelphia, and the person who brought them to Philadelphia was Mr. Blackburn. Slave born, bought, and purchased by a Presbyterian minister in Tennessee, the first ordained African-American minister in the Presbyterian Church, is said to have led African-American Presbyterians to see the light of Christ within each of them. Transfigured, life changed for good, forever. Sometimes moments of transfiguration are filled with the clarity of purpose and peace. And sometimes transfiguration happens in what the great theologian Howard Thurman called luminous darkness, like the depths of the ocean where light is different than we know it. Luminous darkness, life illuminated through our experiences of loss and grief, of opportunities denied, life illuminated with disappointment and challenge, moments that tap our abilities to be response-able and to push us to the edge where we must seek new possibilities. Such is the story of Lucy Craft Laney. She was born in Macon, Georgia during slavery, but she was not a slave. Her father had paid the price 20 years prior. He was a Presbyterian minister, and when the Civil War came to an end, it was Lucy's daddy who rang the bells on Washington Avenue Presbyterian Church to celebrate emancipation. At the age of 4, Lucy was reading during a time when African Americans, by law, were not allowed literacy. At the age of 12, Lucy was translating difficult passages of Latin, including Julius Caesar's commentaries on the Gallic War. Although she was able to attend Atlantic University, women were barred from studying the classics. So she graduated from the teacher's training department and promptly set up her own school in the basement of Christ Presbyterian Church in Augusta, Georgia. The laws may have been crumbling about who could learn and who couldn't, but the finances had not changed. The only way to really support a minority school was through the churches at that time. When Lucy discovered that she had a number of children that would no longer fit in the basement of the church, she gathered what money she had, barely enough to buy a one-way railway ticket to the General Assembly, which was being held that year in Minneapolis, Minnesota, hoping to find financial aid. The General Assembly denied her plea. but they magnanimously paid her fare home. Fortunately, there was a woman in the crowd named Francine E.H. Haynes who heard that story that day. She would become a lifetime benefactress, and she bears the name on the school that Lanny started, Haynes Institute in Augusta, Georgia. Lanny served as its principal from 1883 to 1833, 50 years. She went on to start a kindergarten in Augusta, and she started a school for black nurses as well. Presbyterian elder Lucy Craft Lanny, the Reverend Henry McNeil Turner, and the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. were the first African Americans to have their portraits hung in the Georgia State Capitol. They were selected by then-Governor Jimmy Carter, 40 years after Lanny's death. Lanny's portrait bears the words, "The mother of the children of the people, a woman who knew that God didn't use any different dirt to make me than the first lady of the land." Ironically, nearly 90 years after her death, the National Black Presbyterian Caucus now boasts one of its five awards as the Lucy Craft Lanny Award, honoring individuals who refuse to be defined by the limiting constraints imposed upon them. It is an award that should probably go to the acclaimed Mary Jane McLeod Bethune as well, educator, stateswoman, philanthropist, humanitarian, womanist, and civil rights advocate, and close personal friend of Franklin D. and Eleanor Roosevelt. Her life goal was to be a missionary in Africa. So she went to Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, and upon her graduation, she went back to the Presbyterians and asked for a mission appointment in Africa. They turned her down. It was denied. She was black. Although Mary never got over her disappointment, she held firm to her belief in God's role in her personal history. Mary's missionary focus shifted from Africa to Africans in America. The Presbyterian Board of Education sent her to study under the inspiring leadership of the former slave, Lucy Craft Lanny, at Haynes Normal Institute in Augusta, Georgia. Transfigured, life changed for good forever. Perhaps one of the most popular African-American Presbyterians is Elder Catherine G. Johnson, the mathematician featured in the book and the 2016 movie hit, Hidden Figures. Born on August 26, 1918, and still living. That can't be right. It's 1908 and still living. No, it's 1918, excuse me. Johnson was the brains behind one of the greatest operations in history. It was her numbers that put John Glenn into orbit. She was the first African-American woman to receive the Presidential Award of Freedom. She was a commissioner to the 187th General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church, where she served on the Finance Committee. A member of Carver Memorial Presbyterian Church in Newport News, Virginia, she was a choir member for 50 years. Transfigured, life changed for good forever. Not an African-American story, yet a story closer to our hearts is that of Cephas Washburn. Cephas, a stone, the name given by Jesus to the chosen Simon Peter. Cephas Washburn. Like a stone skipping across a creek, creating infinite ripples, the ancient stories intersect with modern stories as we remember that the life and work of Cephas Washburn has changed forever the lives of many in eastern Oklahoma. Born in 1793 to a farming family in Vermont, Washburn turned from farming to education when he broke his leg and thought it would permanently impair his ability to be a farmer. He went into teaching, and to raise money, he taught. It was during this time that he became a Congregationalist and soon decided that he wanted to work amongst the native peoples of North America. He first was sent to the Savannah mission by the Savannah missionaries to work with the Eastern Cherokees. He later established what became Old Dwight Mission for the Western Cherokees on the Illinois Bayou in Arkansas. At that time, as many as 4,000 Cherokee had fled their troubles in Eastern homeland, and with the help of a treaty, were trying to establish a new homeland in Arkansas. Washburn, his wife, his brother-in-law, Reverend Alfred Finney, and others sought to provide education and spiritual support for the displaced Cherokee. Washburn served as a superintendent at the Old Dwight Mission, and in 1829, when the Western Cherokee moved into the Indian Territory near Salisaw, Oklahoma, Washburn was there with them, sympathetic to the Cherokees' loss of native lands and interested in their traditions. He continued as superintendent at Dwight Mission until 1840, when he retired from missionary service to raise and educate his family. Two of those children were born at Dwight Mission. The decision to resettle probably had a lot to do with the major influx in the Trail of Tears that brought thousands and thousands of Eastern Cherokee into Oklahoma. They diluted the influence of the Western Cherokee with whom Washburn had worked for two decades. Washburn went ahead, after moving to Arkansas, to preach for two more decades. Along the way, he established a short-lived integrated school for Indians and Euro-Americans, and he founded and pastored several churches. Transfigured, life changed for good. Forever. New Dwight Mission became a camp of the Synod of the Sun, May 1951, and has served countless youth and provided hospitality for numerous retreats and meetings. Sometime in the 1980s, the PCUSA survey found that 70% of people in churches at that time made that commitment because they went to a church camp. It's no wonder. Church camp experiences are often described as mountaintop experiences, like transfiguration. The vision of that camp is to create a sense of community where no one is a stranger, a safe place to explore spirituality, a place where you allow the time to rest in the gloaming hours of sunset, those moments of awe, a place where the sun breaks through the hills as you hold the stories of God's people in your hands. Although the future of Dwight Mission may be in transition on this day, I am hopeful that those who have been eyewitnesses to God's amazing love, grace, peace, and community, stories of transfiguration, life changed forever for the good, will live on in you like ripples that cross the creek. Amen.